tuning in today. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice Radio. You can catch three new shows every week on our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. You can also hear the first hour on Stitcher, on our YouTube channel, and we used to be on iTunes, but we were recently censored off of there, so you can no longer find us via Apple's iTunes podcast service. But you can still add our feed manually in iTunes on your computer and get the radio program that way. That's no problem, but you can't search and find Red Ice Radio in the iTunes store anymore. They decided that you shouldn't hear the kind of material that we cover on this program. So there you go. Thanks, Apple. If you're on a mobile device, just get a good podcast app and add our feed that way. The free feed or the members feed, if you're a member or not, doesn't matter. And tune in that way. It's very easy. We do have some podcast app recommendations and full instructions on how to pull this off in our FAQ on redicemembers.com. So check that out for easy access on iPhone, iPad, Android, Kindle, or Windows Phone. Our program today is on health and food. We have Nora Gedgaudas with us. She is a widely recognized expert on what is popularly referred to as the paleo diet. She is the author of the international best-selling book Primal Body, Primal Mind, Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and a Longer Life. She is also the author of the newly released book Rethinking Fatigue, What Your Adrenals Are Really Telling You and What You Can Do About It. She's also a highly experienced nutritional consultant, speaker, and educator. She maintains a private practice in Portland, Oregon, as both a board-certified nutritional consultant and a board-certified clinical neurofeedback specialist. We do have a lot to discuss today on health, fat, protein, good food versus bad food, the bad effects of grain and farming overall, and of course, what to eat to be thinking right. Welcome back, Nora. Great having you back with us once again. How have you been since we talked last? It was a couple of years ago now.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years, Henrik, but I'm thrilled to be back. I love this program. And I've been unbelievably busy, just things are taking off in all different directions for me. And it's been good. It's all been good. I have a new book out, a new ebook. It's in an ebook format. That one basically talks about the impact of what a lot of people think of as adrenal fatigue or adrenal burnout, but it's bringing that whole subject into the 21st century and helping people understand it in the context of modern science, which most approaches to adrenal issues don't actually. Most approaches to adrenal issues are really based on 1950s. Science, which has actually proven not to be true. So we can certainly get into that later, but and I've been traveling a lot. I just did a month-long tour through Australia, spoke to thousands of people in seven different cities. It was a very successful tour, touring with a celebrity chef there named Pete Evans, and we're sort of extolling the virtues of a Paleolithic way of life, modern day sort of approach to Paleolithic eating and lifestyle. And so at any rate, I'm very happy to be here and happy to cover whatever it is that you would like us to cover.
Definitely. Great. Excellent. Now, last time you were with us, we talked about Primal Body and Primal Mind, of course, your previous book, and focus on the paleo diet and everything else. And this is a really big topic, and I think it's really important as well, because it's funny, because it's kind of on a more culture level as well. We've been looking back into history of our ancestors to see how did we live before, you know, this modern world, ascended on or descended upon us, you know. And I wanted to bring you back again because and get into some of your work in this as well, because it's so important to, I mean, the health issue is everything, really. I mean, if you don't have health, everything else is secondary, really. Taking care of yourself is the most important thing. It's from this position that you're, of course, first and foremost capable of even helping others, and especially, you know, if you don't want to be a burden on others, either if that's due to your own poor choices of lifestyle, or if there's already being a burden on the already overloaded healthcare systems around the world, really. Right. But, you know, a lot of people are not well, and this is not only, you know, something that affects your body, but your mind as well, you know, how we think and how well we think,
yeah.
You know. But I wanted to discuss a bit more about the importance of the paleo diet, and especially a little bit later, we'll touch a little bit on the hormone issue as well, something that a lot of people are struggling with today, too much estrogen mimickers, chemicals,
yeah.
You know, and even estrogenic foods like soy and grains and those kinds of things. But as an outset here, maybe you can just give us a quick rundown again on what the paleo diet is, what the, you know, ideas or philosophy, if we can call it that, behind the paleo diet is.
Well, so basically what we're talking about are, it's predicated on the idea that anything that would have been available to us as food throughout the vast majority, nearly 3 million years worth of our evolutionary history, would have basically served to forge our basic physiological makeup, and it would have also basically have forged our nutritional requirements, and that anything that we can do to closely mimic the kinds of foods that would have been available to us in Paleolithic times and prehistoric times and pre-agricultural times would be a diet that would be recognized as most natural for our bodies. And that's just common sense. And to me, that is an essential starting place. It's not an end point. It's a starting place to look at that. Of course, you know, the subtitle of my book, Primal Body, Primal Mind, is Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and a Longer Life. And what I mean by beyond is the fact that just because our ancestors did something, you know, do we absolutely know that that is optimal for us now? And where we look to get the best information about that, in my personal view, is human longevity research. In other words, how can we tweak the principles that they lived by in a way that maximizes their optimization for our, you know, for the way Mother Nature works and also for the world that we live in now, which is quite a bit different and, in my view, perhaps quite a bit more hostile than the one that our ancestors knew.
Yeah.
You know, for the threats we used to face, I think species were quite a bit more visible to us than they are today. Many of us are oblivious to the things that we're facing, I think, as health challenges. And, you know, you make an excellent point about health being central to everything, because right now, I mean, even economically, here in the United States, the number one cause of bankruptcy is a bad diagnosis.
Yeah.
So, and really, if you have that bad diagnosis, do you really care what the banksters are doing? Do you really care what's happening anywhere else in the world?
Exactly.
And you know, there are all sorts of hidden costs on all kinds of levels. I think a lot of people become really cynical about the whole health issue, partly because there's so much conflicting information. You know, about what does and doesn't constitute a healthy diet. So people throw up their arms and say, well, you got to die of something. I'm just going to eat what I want to eat. But they're not thinking it through. You know, I think people have this subconscious imagining that they're going to be walking along munching on their McDonald's or some Krispy Kreme or something like that. And then they're just going to fall over dead and that'll be the end of it. So what? But it's not, you know, usually that clean and cut and dried. You know, do you really want to end up with a diagnosis of cancer? Do you want to end up with a diagnosis of diabetes and have to prick your finger every hour to figure out what's going on with your blood sugar and shoot yourself up with insulin and face things like, you know, amputations of various body parts? Do you want to have a stroke and be completely impaired in your ability to function and be forced to rely on your loved ones to change your diaper and whatever else?
Yeah.
Do you want to experience Alzheimer's or some form of dementia later in life? I'm dealing with that right now in my own family, and I'm here to tell you that is about the ugliest way to go that
yeah,
I can imagine.
I can imagine. Oof. I haven't seen it personally up close, but I've heard from a lot of you know, friends and other family members have struggled with this, and it seems to be obviously the most difficult for the people in their surrounding. Obviously, they've known these people in one way and then see this personality change, really horrible, you know?
Right. You know, the afflictions that people face and that people fear, you know, are largely diseases of modern civilization. These are diseases that have emerged over the last 10,000 years or so. We know from the fossil record that things like cancer all kinds of skeletal, abnormalities and osteoporosis and things like that were completely, almost completely unknown once upon a time. You know, the fact is that, we began to suffer the ill effects of diet the day that we adopted agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
As, and we went for 100,000 generations, not 100,000 years, which would be plenty long enough, but we're talking 100,000 generations eating a diet that was basically a hunter-gatherer based diet and mostly hunter, it turns out.
Yeah.
In other words, we've had a diet largely based in animal source foods for the vast majority of our evolutionary history. Now, this is really, really well established through research that's been done at the Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. A guy by the name of Professor Michael Richards has been doing research there for quite some time now, something called stable isotopic research of human bone collagen, where they take remains found from human fossil record throughout our evolutionary history and analyze it to determine what exactly it is that we were eating. And we can look at that with a fair degree of precision now. And this is using something called a ratio mass spectrometer. It's a technology that's been around for more than 40 years, and it's well established. There's nothing woo-woo about this. There are no hidden agendas in this research at all. They're just taking an honest look, you know, what did we eat, what didn't we eat. And what they found is that through the vast majority of our evolutionary history, not only have we been mostly carnivores, but high-level carnivores, but actually even higher-level carnivores than wolves, foxes, bears, or other carnivores of those time periods. And I think what I personally think what we could probably attribute that to was our ability and the technology that we developed in order to be able to hunt things like the Pleistocene megafauna, for instance. You know, you bring down a woolly mammoth, and you've got a family barbecue that's going to last about a week. everything is feast or famine. So whatever we would have killed, we would have eaten. And it would have been, there would have been an enormous amount of fat that we would have consumed along with the protein that we consumed back then. And that fat served to radically accelerate the development of the single most distinguishing human organ, which is the brain. And we can attribute the size of our brain to the meat, and especially the fat of the animals that we hunted throughout our evolutionary history. Our capacity to be able to do all the things that we do as humans, we can thank our hunter-gatherer ancestors for. And interestingly enough, since the adoption of agriculture, we've actually lost just over 10% of our brain volume.
Really? 10%?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. That is actually well established in the literature, and paleoanthropologists know this very, very well. So,
And we know that. I think that, sure, there are some anomaly cases I've heard, allegedly people like missing parts of the brain that still function, etc. But I do believe primarily that volume is actually related to IQ as well.
Yeah, to some degree, the studies seem to suggest that it is. And there have been, some recent, papers published about that just last year. I'm trying to think here if I have that. Well, I don't know if you need the citations, but there was a study published just last year, and there was another one in 2008 called The Decline of the World's IQ. In the journal Intelligence. And, the case is actually pretty well made. There's some out there claiming that, well, no, it's, our brains have simply become more efficient, which, these are the same people that probably like to argue that size doesn't matter, which
right.
sometimes it does. So, but that's not certainly the only thing we have to be concerned about. when we adopted agriculture, we actually began to experience very rapid declines in not just our brain size, but also our physical stature.
Yes.
has diminished. We've begun developing many more chronic and degenerative diseases. We've begun I'm scanning here to try to find a citation.
Yeah. It's like we've become domesticated, for the lack of a better term. Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's certainly an argument can certainly be made for that. We're led to somehow believe that the development of agriculture was some kind of advancement that gave us, the gift, quote unquote, I'll put quotes around that, of civilization.
Mm.
When in reality, agriculture caused a lot of ills on many levels, when it comes to our health. Grains and legumes have always shown some detrimental effect upon human health since their earliest adoption in ancient Sumeria some, 10,000 years ago. And these adverse effects seem to be growing increasingly evident over time. I mean, again, we lost stature, we lost bone density, we lost dental health, and we also began developing things like birth defects and skeletal abnormalities and vitamin and mineral deficiencies, malnutrition. Certainly, again, the beginnings of what might be called the degenerative and other diseases of modern civilization.
And now we're seeing infertility and things like this on the rise,
Right, exactly. Interestingly, too, there's a researcher named Alessio Fasano, who's a Harvard researcher, probably the world's foremost expert on celiac disease, who has said point blank a number of times and in a number of places that no human being on earth can even digest the protein in grains. And, this 10% loss of brain volume since we adopted agriculture is anything that what I would call an evolutionary trend. So, we didn't need grains to develop any sort of sophisticated or advanced society. You are, of course, very familiarly with the whole discovery of Göbekli Tepe, Turkey.
Yeah.
Ancient society that was every bit as sophisticated as anything from ancient Sumeria or Mesopotamia, and about twice as old. But the advanced civilization there that created this incredible site, they were still 100% hunter-gatherers.
That's right.
They were not agriculturists.
Yeah.
So, there's been no greater natural disaster wrought upon the planet or human health than modern-day agriculture, honestly. We went, too, from working an average of 3 hours per day as hunter-gatherers and living in a state of relative freedom to working in a fairly egalitarian societies as well, a lot of the time. And then suddenly we're working, 8 and or more hours a day with backbreaking labor in the fields for what amounts to a nutritionally inferior food, grains. Why? Well, I think that we may very well have become addicted to them. I mean, apart from the morphine-like compounds in grains like gluteomorphin and proteinorphin, which, again, the effects of which are well known among immunologists, they definitely light up opiate centers in the brain. The starch itself lights up opiate receptors in the brain. But we also figured out that we could make beer. And, the ancient Sumerians, credit their gods that they call the Anunnaki for this. And so there were a lot of very tempting things, perhaps, about grains. And it also, I think, allowed for the development of, ruling class hierarchies, which we can all be thankful for, too, right?
Right, yeah.
So, the whole domestication issue is sort of interesting. We do seem to live in order for civilization, the way ours has been constructed, to perpetuate, you know, our wild instincts really need to be suppressed or eliminated through domestication or both. And somehow that seems to have occurred. You know, when you take an animal and you domesticate them, you take them out of their natural wild environment and you concentrate them in large populations in enclosures or concentrated areas, and they end up getting fed foods that are somewhat unnatural to them, and they end up also becoming a lot of the wild instincts are bred out of them.
Yes.
That they're not resistant to being controlled or manipulated in some way. I mean, there are just far too many analogies here to totally dismiss the idea. I'm not saying that that's what happened. I don't know what happened for a fact, but there are a lot of interesting analogies to be drawn here when it comes to the concept of domestication. Raise an eyebrow here and there. So
it should, right?
It should raise an eyebrow.
And to add something into this as well, I think that a lot of people are also in this time that we're now in the modern time with our educational system and everything else are very confused, and we get a lot of wrong information, although I believe that there's a lot of correct research out there. The human being is viewed, unfortunately, today, as far as I've been able to glean from everything, is that we're kind of outside today of the rules of nature, that we're not part of it. We've entered into a bubble isolated from evolution. I mean, for example, a while back, we had Frank Salter with us, an Australian academic and researcher at the former, I think this is the one you mentioned, Max Planck Institute for Behavioral Physiology. Was that the same one?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, evolution. There's also Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. That's right. Anyway, they're related closely. And I remember that he talked about this aspect as well, that even anthropology as well, the study has been very much weaponized. It's like it's not only a war on what Mother Nature is composed of, but even more so of the human being. You know, anthropology, we get a lot of weird, skewed information, down to the fact that they refuse to look at things that actually differs between different, people and races and, genotypes, depending on where their ancestors were brought up in what region they lived for, as you said, for hundreds of thousands of generations. Sure, there was some movement, but again, this idea that there are differences today as opposed to how we lived in the past, is this a big part of it, do you think, in terms of like missing the mark, that we're not getting the right information because anthropology is not honest today?
Well, there's politics and economics that flows through every subject under the sun, whether we're talking about nutrition, whether we're talking about medicine, whether we're talking about anthropology, whether we're talking about climate science, you know, anything. And you have to always sort of take what you're hearing, especially with respect to mainstream sources, with a little bit of a grain of salt and question what the motives behind what is being presented might be. And, you have to dig a little deeper and really look at the underlying evidence for what's being presented and what we're being asked to unquestioningly accept. But certainly, you know, our way of life today is based on seeing ourselves as fundamentally separate from our natural environment. You know, I am not you, you are not me, we are not nature, we are, you know, this thing that exists apart from it, almost as though we're somehow above it in some way. And we're not. We have this illusion of being separate from our natural environment. But, there's nothing in this world that is separate from the natural environment. We just sort of have this, we have created this insulated version of it. We live in cozy, comfy, climate-controlled, homes, and, you know, we don't have to reach more than 2 feet in any direction to have something we can put in our mouths, even as we're still a species that lives, you know, instinctively maybe by feast or famine. Nowadays, we have this unnatural access to this unnatural abundance of food and, dare I say, food-like substances that there are no breaks on any of it. You don't even have to get up off the couch to get something to eat. You can pick up your cell phone and call a pizza delivery service and have them, bring it right to your front door. And if you left the door unlocked, they can deliver it to you sitting right there. So,
It's true.
This is the world we live in. I pass something like 15 fast food joints on my way home from work every single day, and I don't know how many convenience stores and restaurants, and it's insane how we're being asked to eat, or how easy it has become for us to adopt this, to adopt a diet based on convenience, as opposed to a diet based on meeting our nutritional requirements as a species. And diet, and it's not just a diet of convenience. We've also been conditioned to think about food as primarily a nutrient-devoid source of entertainment, you know?
Exactly, yes.
As opposed to nourishment. The focus today is on taste and texture and how fun a food seems and how convenient it is, as opposed to its nutrient density and its intrinsic value to the way that we were designed. You know, we've had no more than about 500 generations now. I mentioned 100,000 generations on what could be termed a paleo diet. And I realize it's not just one type of diet, right?
Yeah.
There are many, many diets throughout history and many areas of the globe that we occupied, many different ecosystems, different things that were available. But there are some underlying principles that are consistently true among the diversity of these different approaches, if you will, to Paleolithic eating. But then we adopt agriculture, and this is less than 500 generations, less than 0.4% of our entire evolutionary history, and we have genetically transformed no more than maybe 0.005% since that time, and not in a positive way.
Right, yeah.
So
it's such a rapid change, and as you say, it's so recent. And I mean, even look at it in terms of obesity. We've developed obviously a taste for salt and sugar and fat to a certain degree as well, because these were scarce in the environment we were that we were living in. But today, of course, with that easy access to it, this is now that genetically or evolutionary developed taste for something is now working towards our detriment, and this is something we have to, control with our intelligence, but that seems to lack in certain aspects as well,
Yeah, it does. I mean, in my mind, there can be nothing more ridiculous than the assertion that every man, woman, and child should be consuming, according to government guidelines, and it's not just in the U.S., it's throughout the world. All these so-called food pyramids are pretty much the same wherever you go, where governments are making these recommendations. Governments that with the nature of your show, I can throw out this conspiracy theory that are governments that are basically the employees, if you will, of multinational corporations.
Sure. Yeah.
So the idea that we should all be consuming 6 to 11 servings of grains per day, according to the stable isotopic research, there's no evidence to suggest that grains were ever, throughout any part of our evolutionary history, any significant part of the human diet. In fact, the stable isotopic evidence is more or less zero for that in the fossil record. I mean, it's not that we didn't ever eat it. Obviously, we must have known those things were edible to us in some way. Otherwise, we never would have adopted them as an alternative food source. But the idea that grains have always been a part of the human diet just simply isn't true, or a significant or meaningful part of the human diet. That was just simply never the case. No human people group in the whole evolutionary history of the human species, in fact, has ever eaten a diet remotely resembling what the modern day government guidelines, generated mainly by politics and economics, suggest is optimal. And furthermore, grains and legumes are what they feed to cattle to fatten them up. I mean, we can all take a hint from that with the skyrocketing rates of obesity. It's not just grains, too. It's obviously things like high fructose corn syrup and the increasing levels of carbohydrates and refined carbohydrates, both, in the diet. But given these preposterous, and exponentially rising rates of obesity throughout the entire industrialized world, it seems that we kind of need to take this as a hint of what government guidelines have been doing for us all along.
Even the grain that we did eat have obviously gone through many changes as well. I mean, we can think back for, what was it, when they found, Ötzi, the Iceman there in the Swiss Alps. He was found, he lived about 3,300 BC,
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
something like that, right?
5,300 years ago.
And it was found with some of the einkorn, right? There was like certain grains in there, but it was still, that's very different than what we have today.
Well,
you know?
And interestingly too, you know, Otzi, he was a complete medical mess. You know, Otzi was not exactly, he was a post-agricultural human. He wasn't, he did some hunting and gathering, but they found, you know, his last meal showed that he had, you know, grains in his teeth. So, and he suffered severe, he had arterial sclerosis. He had severe dental problems. Just his mouth was just filled with cavities.
Interesting. Huh.
And yeah, he was anything but a healthy specimen of a human at the time of his death. He was, I believe, he was arthritic as well. He had a lot of things going for him that weren't anything that we would want going for us. So
yeah,
yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't remember about the various diseases he had attracted. I guess my point there was that, sure, there was some component in that. And certainly, I believe that we have to go way back to get the real true diet, if you were. But my point there being that even the wheat itself, for example, have developed even as late as in the... And now we get the GMO question, of course, in itself, which is just horrendous. But in the 70s,
we had... Well, that's an amplifier. That's just amplifying everything.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You know, but we had the advent of the dwarf wheat strain, for example, and it's got just progressively worse and worse and worse. And again, look at the amount of cancer we have, epidemics, you know, even Alzheimer's, as you mentioned. We could talk more about that later. What is some of the potential preventative measures we can take against these kinds of diseases, you know?
Right. Well, exactly. You know, the interesting thing, too, is that one of the reasons for which, I mean, there was actually an article published in 2009 in the journal Gastroenterology that where they took 10,000 blood samples from 50 years ago and compared them to 10,000 blood samples from people living today. And the 10,000 or the blood samples that they looked at from 50 years ago were being stored, you know, in military hospitals, you know, cryogenically in military hospitals. So, and they did rigorous testing of both sets of samples, and they found that there's literally been a 400% increase in the rate of celiac disease. And of course, celiac disease is only maybe 12% of what constitutes the greater phenomenon, and also well established within the immunologic research of gluten immune reactivity. It goes way beyond celiac disease. So, so this is something that is, you know, a modern day you know, catastrophe, and this doesn't have to do. People think, you know, the people who want to argue about that study say, well, that's because the modern day testing techniques are that much better. And it's not, that's not true at all. If they read the study, they would know that all these samples were tested using the current technology. There's also a quote from the Annals of Medicine in 2010 stating that the prevalence of celiac disease has increased fivefold overall since 1974. And this increase was not due to increased sensitivity of testing, but rather due to an increasing number of subjects that lost the immunological tolerance to gluten in their adulthood.
Wow, yeah.
And maybe 1 to 3 people of everybody suffering from some form of gluten immune reactivity is ever even diagnosed. So it's a much more prevalent problem. But people assume that it's a gut-related problem, and they say, well, my digestion's fine, I don't have a problem. Well, 8 out of 10 celiacs don't have gastrointestinal symptoms. And in fact, in the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery and Psychiatry in 1997, the authors in that peer-reviewed article stated that our finding implies that immune response triggered by sensitivity to gluten may find expression in organs other than the gut, and the central and peripheral nervous systems are particularly susceptible. Hmm. You know, gluten sensitivity may be at times primarily, if not exclusively, and I'm actually quoting from a Journal of Neurology now.
Yeah.
Neurological disease affecting not only the brain and nervous system, but also cognitive and psychiatric illness. And half of everybody, at least half of everybody with gluten immune reactivity is producing antibodies against their own brain and nervous system. So we need to take this the subject seriously. Yes. And here's the other part to this, though. You don't even have to have an immune reactivity to gluten in order for it to do damage to your gut and do damage to your brain. Whenever you consume gluten, which, by the way, nobody can digest in the first place, it stimulates the release of an enzyme called zonulin. Zonulin, basically, I know it sounds like something from a Star Trek movie or, you know, whatever, but it actually is an enzyme that controls intestinal permeability. And the normally very selective, but not just intestinal permeability, also blood-brain barrier permeability. So the same mechanisms actually control both. And when we consume a gluten-containing meal, and I don't care who you are, whether or not you have are demonstrating a gluten immune reactivity, that for several hours following a gluten-containing meal, the presence of zonulin basically throws that semi-permeable gut, selective gut permeability out the window. It's like the gates open up. It's like the bouncer in front of the LA nightclub has fallen asleep, and now all the nerds are trampling over him and getting into the club and ruining the club's reputation because the barrier there, the bouncer wasn't on the job. Okay. And that's right. The gut barrier integrity, also the blood brain barrier integrity. And anything that is undigested or anything in your GI tract that doesn't belong in your bloodstream can work its way in through these open junctions and get on that superhighway called your bloodstream and impact every single organ, including your brain, because your brain looks the same way for that period of time of a few hours following. You know, it's an acute form of permeability that follows a gluten meal, but it occurs. And it's a setup for immunologic reactivity down the line. It's also a setup for your organs and tissues and your brain to be adversely affected by things in your body that wouldn't have to be affected by.
Wow. But also, is it any amount?
Any amount.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and also, there is a lectin in gluten called wheat germ agglutinin that is actually highest in sprouted grains, the ones that are supposed to be healthy for everybody. But it's present in all gluten grains. And wheat germ agglutinin is actually able to cross the blood-brain barrier all on its own, even without the help of zonulin or whatever else, and attach itself to your myelin and block the production of nerve growth factor, which in effect is, you know, the way your brain maintains and regenerates itself. So in effect, it's a form of potential brain damage associated with consuming gluten, even without an immune reactivity. So in other words, grains are effectively not a health food for anyone. I don't care who you are. The idea that there is no such thing as anyone wandering the face of the earth with a grain deficiency. It's just not out there. These are foods that are incredibly new to us. You were mentioning, you know, the dwarf wheat and all that sort of a thing. I think part of the problem, too, is that every time we hybridize these crops, you know, grains and legumes and things, we create about 5% new proteins. And those 5% new proteins are something our immune system has to reckon with. We have to adapt to that. It takes a long time to adapt to changes in our food supply. And we just haven't had a chance to adapt to what we were eating 10,000 years ago, much less what is being hybridized today. Plus, industry is selecting for more gluten in the grains because they find it useful in food manufacturing and baking and whatever else. And I think our genome is also just that much more vulnerable. You know, where we had the Industrial Revolution maybe a couple hundred years ago, and maybe 13 generations or so that has been exposed to an increasing amount of processed food in our diet. And, you know, this kind of thing leads to increased vulnerability with each subsequent generation. You know, you can't have a healthy genome if what's supplying that genome's biochemistry is deteriorating the biochemistry.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
yeah, because that's a worry I have. It's like, okay, is the damage like already done due to what my ancestors ate, or is this something? Do you think that there's we can repair this very quickly depending on how we change our lifestyle now, or is it the same way in reverse that we'll better get on the right bandwagon here right away in order to prevent what is coming due to what we've done?
Well, I think that there are a lot of steps that we can take. I mean, obviously, you know, we were born the product of the generations that preceded us, and so we have a certain genetic makeup to work with. But, you know, genetics are maybe, you know, are a small part of the equation. It's epigenetics, right? It's what we do with our diet and our environment to influence the expression of our genes. I mean, just because you have a gene for something doesn't mean that gene is going to be expressed in your lifetime. We all have genes for all kinds of awful things. Whether or not a gene expresses itself or not is predicated on the environment in which that gene exists and what we supply that environment with. And so what control, you know, genes are controlled by regulatory genes. Regulatory genes are largely controlled by nutrients in our diet and other environmental factors and epigenetics. So we have a tremendous amount of control over how our genes express themselves. And to me, again, looking at the world we live in today, what we're faced with, coupled with what's happening in human longevity research, were the things that I wanted to take and make modifications to those foundational Paleolithic principles in order to better the results that we can get from a, you know, from a better foundational diet. So, you know, that the world that we live in today is we've got things going on today that our most primitive ancestors, you know, our evolutionary antecedents could not have even begun to fathom.
Yeah.
It's really crazy. Everything from genetically modified foods and pesticides and herbicides and air and water pollutants and, you know, depleted soils and EMF pollution and this crazy kind of 24-hour daylight that we've created in the form of electricity that has done, I think, a considerable amount to screw up our circadian rhythms and invisible threats like radiation that the world is facing many times over right now in ways that most people are just either are unaware of or choose to be unaware of.
Yeah.
And this change, you know, to a more sort of industrialized food supply, together with the kinds of stresses and pressures we put ourselves under in modern times. I mean, you know, our ancestors would have thought we were nuts for putting on gym shoes and you know, spending hours on a treadmill at a gym, much less, you know, working, 40-hour work weeks and everything else that we do nowadays. We subject ourselves to massive amounts of stress that are completely unnatural to us. And we reap the consequences of that as well. That adds to our vulnerability in very precarious times. So if you can't afford to be sick, and I don't know who can on any level, you can't afford to not eat optimally well as a way of taking control of one little piece of things that we still have at least some control over. I kind of I have this analogy that I like to throw out there that I like to think is a useful analogy, because when you look at just the sheer weight of everything we're facing as a species right now, it's easy to become very depressed and go into a state of despair over it, almost a futility, if you will.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's not the way I look at it. When I see this stuff, it turns me into a Girl Scout. You know, I'm thinking, okay, so this is happening. This, what can I do about that? You know, how can I modify what I'm doing in order to compensate for this as best as possible? And I used to participate in martial arts, and one of the things we sometimes would do in class is we would try to simulate a real-life situation. So somebody comes up to you in a dark alleyway and grabs your arm. You know, it's human nature to look at that, at what's being restricted in that moment as in kind of a state of panic and be focused on, oh, my God, I'm trapped, I'm being restricted, somebody's got me. I'm doomed, you know, whatever is going through your mind at that moment. And in martial arts training, what you're trained to do in that moment is acknowledge what's being restricted, but then shift your focus to what's not being restricted. Oh, look, you've got another arm you could punch them with. You've got two legs, two knees that you could knee them with. You've got feet, you could run. You've got two elbows. You can headbutt. You can scream. There are a lot of things that you can do to improve the outcome of that situation. And, you know, I sort of jokingly call it becoming a Prime Ninja Warrior, where in the light of all the things and in this time period that we seemingly, I'll say seemingly, have no control over, it is incumbent upon us to take responsibility for one thing, but also do to take responsibility for and to do what we can, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And again, what we choose to eat is something we still have some control over, and there are forces hard at work removing our ability to control even that. But we still have some control over that. And if you don't have your foundational health, you've got nothing. You have no quality of life. Everything that you experience in your life is predicated on the health of your body and especially your brain. And, you know, it's not about quantity of life. It's about quality of life along the way. I could get hit by a train tomorrow, but my brain is still intact. My physical health is still intact. My capacity to contribute in my life is still intact, and to experience, you know, the love and care of those around me and anything else that makes life worthwhile and meaningful is still within my grasp. And that's what matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so, definitely. Now, I wanted to ask you here a little bit as well, because there's so many more things I want to ask you and talk more about in terms of the foods, of course. There's this huge anti-fat trend right now, and the longevity research in itself is something I'm going to touch upon later. But what I thought we could do is, let's tie stress into this a little bit before we wrap things up with the first hour, and that way we can kind of talk a little bit more about your latest ebook, Rethinking Fatigue.
Sure.
What are some of the consequences of stress, and how does that tie into the, you know, adrenal system and the way, you know, the way people live their lives today, and how is this, you know, draining us and working against us health wise?
Right. Well, again, you know, we live in this profoundly and abnormally stressful world today in modern times, and of course, your stress management capacity is going to either make or break, you know, your health or quality of life. You can be seemingly doing everything else right, even eating a good diet, but stress alone, especially if it's mismanaged, can totally unravel you. And a typical stress reaction literally generates a cascade of about 1,400 biochemical events in your body, and managing those reactions is pretty essential toward optimizing your health, but also your aging process and your brain function. What stands, you know, between that sort of modern day, if you will, stress monolith and our health is in significant measure the health of our adrenal function. But unfortunately, adrenal-related issues are really pretty poorly understood by most people and even a lot of natural healthcare providers in this day and age. And they're often still based on a very outdated 1950s model of stress physiology that was originally presented by a scientist by the name of Dr. Hans Selye, who was a Canadian endocrinologist. He was actually nominated close to 10 times for the Nobel Prize, so he wasn't any kind of slouch. But he had this sort of theoretical model of stress physiology that, it turns out, when you really look at things in the light of the 21st century day, just doesn't really bear out to be true. But, you know, our adrenals are our stress hormone factories, and they're points to respond to the stressors we face or the stress, you know, that we impose upon them. You know, and I'm inclined to say that stress isn't really what happens to us, it's how we respond to what happens to
right.
us. So to me, that's the important thing to remember. And stress can be either or both physical or emotional or even physiological. You know, certainly the effect is always going to be physiological. But they're there, our stress hormones are there to keep us alive, and they're there to help us deal with emergencies. So we're actually not meant to live in a state of perpetual state of emergency. And our stress hormones are actually designed to work in a much more kind of punctuated fashion, if you will, you know, mainly under particularly challenging or maybe threatening circumstances. So they rapidly raise our blood sugar levels up, which is our version of rocket fuel. And that's designed to give us the shot of energy that we need to deal with that emergency, like, you know, for instance, needing to outrun something like a cantankerous woolly mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger or maybe an ugly blind date or whatever. You know, but small amounts of hormones like cortisol are also necessary for other things. So cortisol isn't all bad. We need it to maintain a healthy gut lining. It helps us manage stress in our lives in small amounts. Too much or too little can be problematic. But our bodies and brains were really only designed to handle so much at a time. We're not supposed to be marinated in cortisol 24/7, much less on an ongoing basis. We're actually designed to be functioning in this calm, relaxed, parasympathetic state 99.99% of the time. And our brains especially so. And our nervous systems are supposed to be operating in this relatively relaxed, calm state throughout the majority of our lives. And we're maybe designed to be in a state of sympathetic arousal, meh, I don't know, 0.1% of the time. You know, when the shift into survival mode is called for due to some obvious emergency or need for physical exertion or whatever have you. But unfortunately, this whole thing has flip-flopped. And most of us are actually being chased around by cantankerous woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers 99.99% of the time. And then the other, you know, 0.1% of the time, if you're fortunate enough to have the luxury of this, you know, mythical thing called a vacation, you know, you can travel to an exotic location with white sandy beaches and swaying palms, and you can be there just long enough to stress out the natives and then head back to the state of chaos that you call your life to resume that chronic state of self-abuse. But our ancestors never would have comprehended that way of doing things, and our bodies and brains just simply aren't designed for it. So it's a very, very real problem.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the model that Selye presented in his theories were of sort of a chronic progressive stage of adrenal exhaustion based on exposure, the amount of stress that you're exposed to over the course of your life. So as you're increasingly exposed to stress, that the adrenals, you know, shift from kind of an alarm phase where the cortisol gets really elevated or high, and then over chronic exposure to stress, then you move into a resistance stage where it can be either high or low, and eventually you go into this exhaustion stage where cortisol becomes chronically depressed, and then, you know, you're pounding the last nail in the coffin because your adrenals are two smoldering little nuggets and they're gone. And it turns out that just isn't the way that it works. Now, one thing that is true about what he said was that, you know, cortisol is released as part of kind of a generally predictable daily circadian rhythm. It's highest in the morning when we first get up, and it tends to decline, gradually decline throughout the course of the day, and it should be at its lowest level during the night when we're sleeping, which makes sense. Basically, most of what's thought of as adrenal dysregulation isn't glandular at all. And Selye's model was basically a glandular model. And that's part of what I refer to as sort of a myth around this. You know, your adrenal glands are basically two little tiny hormone factories sitting on top of your kidneys. They literally do what they are told to do by your brain. Mm. And if you're experiencing dysregulation, one of the first places to look, not the only place to look, but one of the first places to look is brain-based mechanisms and brain-based dysregulation that result in faulty signaling to your adrenal glands, or maybe a poor integration of your cortisol rhythms. And, you know, the brain, there was a study in Physiology Reviews back in 2007 by a guy named Bruce Sherman McEwen, who's done a lot of research around this. I have another influence as well with respect to some of this research, a man by the name of Dr. Datis Karazian, who's very much an expert on the brain and nervous system and how it relates to endocrinology. But Bruce McEwen in this study says the brain is the key organ of the response to stress because it determines what is threatening and therefore potentially stressful, as well as the physiological and behavioral responses, which can be either adaptive or damaging. So what I've found is that there are four different areas of the brain. And by the way, I've been working for 20 years. Part of, in addition to having this passion for nutritional science and looking at diet and health from an evolutionary perspective, which is to me the only rational way to look at it,
yeah.
I also do something called neurofeedback, which is a kind of a sophisticated form of brain training. And in neurofeedback circles, like EEG biofeedback, right?
Yeah.
I've seen every kind of brain dysregulation that you could possibly shake a stick at over 20 years. It's, you know, working with 8 clients a day, every day, 5 days a week for the last 20 years. I've learned a thing or two about the brain. And And we've long in the field looked at the brain as being a much more central regulatory thing for adrenal dysfunction. But you can kind of break it down into four different areas of the brain that tend to be involved in regulating adrenal function. There's the hypothalamic pituitary axis. Now, that helps to control the amount of cortisol that you're producing at any given time. There's the hippocampus, which is a part of your temporal lobes just over the tops of your ears. And that part of your brain actually manages what you can think of as the cortisol rhythm, the adrenal cortisol rhythm. There's a part at the top of your brainstem called the mesencephalic midbrain. And that part of your brain, it's also very limbic, very kind of primal part of your brain, is very much involved with the amplitude of your adrenal response at any given time. And then there's your pineal gland, which is in part responsible for helping to regulate the cortisol and melatonin balance. And what I've done in my book, which is called my new book, it's an ebook called Rethinking Fatigue, What Your Adrenals Are Really Telling You and What You Can Do About It, is I've taken and actually, and it goes beyond actually just these four areas of the brain. There are other things too, including mitochondrial dysfunction, autoimmunity, and other things that can contribute to what we think of as adrenal-related issues, free radical processes, whatever. I've broken it down to the kinds of symptoms that may be typical of these different types of dysregulation that the reader can use as a screening tool to figure out where it fits for them. And then what I offer in conjunction with that are a list of things that have shown to be helpful for supporting and helping to manage those issues. Now, I also talk about the kinds of tests you might want to order, have your doctor or healthcare provider, you know, your knowledgeable and, you know, qualified healthcare provider order, to help figure out exactly where you're at for sure. But people see themselves in the mirror of these descriptions all the time. I mean, I've had people write me every day since this book was released last month and say, oh my God, you described me to a T. It's like you knew me, you know. Yeah. I never thought of it this way, and this so totally makes sense for me. And the book is really designed to be very self-empowering. It's like, I can't work with everybody anymore. I'm not even taking new clients anymore because I'm too overwhelmed with other demands. So this book is a way of my being able to hand, you know, myself off to people and say, here, it's in here, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And you can apply what you need to from this, and also find a healthcare provider that can help you order some of the tests and things like that. So, you know, I don't know how much you want to go into all these different things and how they look. We can talk about it more. I don't want to monopolize because I know you've got lots of other questions too. But I think that chronic fatigue and or issues of feeling people suffering from chronic states of anxiety or exhaustion or brain fog, or people who just can't seem to get it together and function in any kind of, not just even peak capacity, but even a, you know, functional capacity.
Yeah.
Is a really kind of endemic problem to modern day life. And there are a lot of different mechanisms at play. We're all tempted to want to boil it down to being one thing. And it seldom is just one thing.
You're
sometimes,
right. Yeah.
Sometimes lucky. But there's a lot of gray area that has to be considered. And sometimes it's layers of things that we have to dig through in order to figure out what's actually going on with us. And when I wrote Primal Body, Primal Mind, you know, it's like 15 books in one, at least, I don't know, where you're talking about the paleo diet, you're not just talking about one subject. You know, as we were talking about before we came on the air, you know, we're literally talking about, you know, 20 or more different subjects,
yeah.
Any one of which is going to be extremely involved, many of which are going to challenge many mainstream assumptions. And so lots of groundwork has to get laid in order to kind of make the case for why everybody needs to kind of take the subject seriously and consider this approach to eating. as something quite a bit more optimal than what we're told. And, you know, I know that there are the arguments out there that, you know, our Paleolithic ancestors, oh, they all died when they were 30 or 40 anyway, so they didn't live long enough to develop, you know, diseases you know, which, look, when we adopted for starters, when they talk about average age of mortality, when they're discussing those statistics, that's what they're talking about are averages that are taking into account infant mortality. And you also have to consider the fact that our ancient ancestors, they weren't living in climate controlled environments with all kinds of contrivances to insulate them from heat or extreme cold or discomfort in some way.
It's amazing they lived as long as they did. I mean, some tribes walked along the ice sheet hunting. You know, it's like extreme extreme environments that had tremendous pressure on the body. And I think that if they would have had a diet we have today, they wouldn't even have lived 10 years. We, as you said before, we wouldn't even be here today if that was the case.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, we're very much creatures of the Ice Age. But the Ice Age isn't just about snow and ice, as I'm sure you know, you're well aware of. Ice ages were about extremes of cold, extremes of heat, drought, you know, wildfires, floods, megastorms, and also very widespread volcanic activity that would have, you know, had a major impact on the growth of available, especially edible vegetation and things like that over, you know, sometimes many millennia. And so, you know, we really were very much forged by the extremes of the environment that we evolved in. And we've been living for the last 10,000 years in an unusually temperate time period. If you go online and you look at, I actually have a diagram representing what is called the Milankovitch cycle.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, in my book. And I'm sure you've had guests that have talked about this before on the air. And, you know, it shows the predictability of glacial advance and glacial retreat. The data points go back at least, you know, 420,000 years or so. But you can see it's just predictable as clockwork, about every 11,500 years, we're shifting into either a period of glacial advance or glacial retreat. But there are also cycles within these cycles, sometimes lasting, 100,000 years or more. So, and this is all related to Earth's relationship to the sun and also solar activity. And what you look at when you look at that graphic depiction of the Milankovitch cycle is you see that for maybe not more than about 10% of the last 500,000 years alone, we've had average global temperatures. Now we're talking average. Right, global mm-hmm. temperatures of about 0 degrees centigrade or way below that in some instances, which wouldn't have necessarily radically changed what was happening in equatorial regions during these time periods, but would have influenced that some, but would certainly have influenced the nature of what kinds of extremes we were facing in terms of climatic challenge during those times and volcanic activity and things like that, which definitely were experienced in the tropics as well.
Yeah.
So, and when you look at the last tiny little, almost insignificant looking blip at the right hand of that graph, what you see is the encapsulation of the entire time period that we think of as human civilization. It's this tiny, tiny little heartbeat, not even on that time scale. And we think of the world we're living in today as, you know, is always pretty much like this. Maybe it was colder at times. So what? We threw on a few furs. We were fine. And we don't realize what kinds of extreme forces really shaped our genome. And we're still that same, you know, genetically, you know, by and large, we're still, you know, that same being today.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, you know, there's just a tremendous amount of variables to take in consideration here, but I'm just amazed and you know, over this idea that we've seemed to isolated ourselves in this bubble, that we somehow we're outside of it, or it doesn't affect us anymore, or we can do whatever we want. I mean, overall, just this idea that there is no consideration for ancestors, what they did, how they lived, and all these aspects. And it's so important, you know, to kind of try to picture ourselves under what circumstances and of course, in what way they lived, and of course, what food they ate, to be able to, you know, follow up on that. We can't just, you know, change the behavior overnight and expect not to see any results from that. But there's a lot of more things I want to get into here. It's just a tremendous amount of more questions I have for you. I hope we can get to them all. But why don't we do like this? Let's take a little short break here between the segments first. But I want you to mention your books again, Rethinking Fatigue, the latest one, ebook, and then, of course, Primal Body, Primal Mind. And give us the website that you have for these and where people can go to pick up copies.
Well, the new ebook, the newest book, is called Rethinking Fatigue, What Your Adrenals Are Really Telling You and What You Can Do About It. And that and my other book, Primal Body, Primal Mind, Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and a Longer Life, are both available through my www.primalbody-primalmind.com website. You can go there, and the links are there. Primal Body, Primal Mind, obviously, it benefits me if you buy it through my website, but it's also available in every bookstore, and it's available in all the ebook formats as well. Rethinking Fatigue is strictly available in an ebook format, and is going to be part of an ebook series I'm creating on specific topics. But yes, and you can sign up for a free newsletter and be in the loop, because there are also some exciting new developments occurring that I think many people that are interested in these subjects are going to want to know about. So, and I won't abuse your email ever. You will never get a spam from me. So, or as a result of me, I don't sell anybody's email information. So.
All right. Great. Well, good to know that. Thank you, Nora. And so again, then the website here, primalbody-primalmind.com. We're going to have this up and we're going to link up the books as well, and check it out. There's a lot of good stuff here that we've been talking about, which is, of course, very, very important in terms of health, you know, comparatively how we live today as opposed to in the past. And, yeah, we have much more to get to, so stay with us, Nora. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back with more. All right, we'll continue for another hour and a half with Nora at redicemembers.com for much more on her work and expertise. In the second hour, we discuss the problem with a vegetarian or vegan diet. We talk about the anti-fat craze and that this actually is very detrimental, full-on dangerous actually, as fat is fuel for the body. This leads to problems with your mental processes and can also lead to issues of infertility and a lot of other problems. We get into hormones, chemicals, and longevity research. And later we talk about what to eat. We talk about some examples and that from, nose to tail philosophy is not something that we do and apply anymore. We seldomly eat organs, for example, or bone marrow like other animals do. And it's here where we have a lot of good fat and nutrients. So we kind of get into that a little bit more. So lots of good tips coming up. We'll continue at redicemembers.com. Go there to subscribe and tune in. We have a lot of material for you there and your family or close friends to enjoy. So sign up and help us out, and we'll talk more there. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back with more.